Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carville. Coming up tonight, Judge Smithick finds the Gardaí did collude with the IRA to kill two RUC men.
The findings of Judge Smithick are both incredible and shocking.
I want to, on behalf of the government and the state, unreservedly apologise to the families of both men.
And should charities replace the role of the state? All to come on The Late Debate after the news. It's read now by Una O'Hagan.
Good evening. The Minister for Justice, Alan Chatter, has apologised for any failings by the state or its agencies identified in the Smithick Tribunal report. It found there was collusion in the killing of two RUC superintendents in South Armagh in 1989. Chief Superintendent Harry Breen and Superintendent Bob Buchanan were shot dead by the IRA shortly after leaving Dundalk Garda Station. Mr Justice Peter Smithick concluded that an unidentified IRA mole leaked information about their movements on the day they were killed. He also criticised the initial investigations of the murders. The solicitor for the Buchanan family, Ernie Waterworth, praised the work of the tribunal.
It was initially very sceptical. I believed that there would be, for want of a better word, a whitewash. I've been proved wrong in that, and I do acknowledge that that was a mistake on my part. I think the judge has been excellent in his pursuit of the truth as he can find it.
The Department of Health is to ask the European Commission for an extra year to allow the VHI be reformed into a new private corporate structure and to end the unlimited state guarantee it enjoys. The Cabinet agreed today that the Department seek to negotiate with the Commission to extend the original deadline of the end of this month to December 2014. The aim is to allow the VHI to generate sufficient funds to meet minimum solvency levels and avoid the need for any cash injection from the state under its new structure. Some of that funding is expected to be raised from the reinsurance market. Foreign ministers from NATO have condemned the use of what they describe as excessive force against pro-European protesters in Ukraine. They issued the statement after a meeting in Brussels. The US Secretary of State John Kerry urged Ukraine to, as he put it, listen to the voices of its people. Mass demonstrations were sparked by the government's decision not to sign an agreement with the European Union last week.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Dimplex. Get cast iron quality and reduce your heating bills with solid fuel stoves from Dimplex, the name you can trust.
Rain will slowly spread southeastwards tonight. Colder and clearer conditions will develop later. Frost and mist patches will form with the risk of ice. Lowest temperatures 0 to 3 degrees. Cool and bright tomorrow with showers in the west and north. That's all for now. There'll be news again at 11.
Una, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. Later tonight, we'll be discussing the ongoing controversy surrounding the Central Remedial Clinic and the payments from charity donations to top up its executive salaries. And with me for that discussion will be independent TD Shane Ross, Fianna Fáil TD Sean Fleming, disability rights campaigner Martin Nocton, and the chief executive of The Wheel, Deirdre Garvey. First, though, to the Smithick Tribunal report, which was published this evening. Judge Smithick spent 7 years investigating whether members of the Gardaí colluded with the IRA into the murders of Chief Superintendent Harry Breen and Superintendent Bob Buchanan in South Armagh in March 1989. The two senior RUC men had just left a meeting at Dundalk Garda Station. Judge Smithick has found that there was collusion, but he couldn't identify the source of the collusion. He found that a Garda leaked information about the men's movements to the IRA, which set in train the chain of events which culminated in their brutal assassinations. Speaking this evening, Superintendent Buchanan's son William gave this reaction.
I have previously commented that neither I or any family member has ever sought an inquiry into the brutal murder of my father, Bob Buchanan. Almost 25 years from the murder, 8 years from the commencement of the private investigation by Judge Smithick, and 2 years of hearing the evidence, we have now received the report. I know that a mole theory has been in the background from the outset, but this was very quickly discounted by the then Chief Constable of the RUC and the Garda Commissioner at the time of the murders. The findings of Judge Smithick are both incredible and shocking, and confirm the existence of a mole in Dundalk Station. This led to my father's death and that of his colleague Harry Breen. I, on behalf of my sister and the wider Buchanan family, wish to place on record our appreciation for the diligence and integrity of Judge Peter Smithick and his team. They have been untrying in their performance of their task, and we trust the state will take cognizance of the findings and learn valuable lessons for the future.
That was William Buchanan. Well, Judge Smithick issued a series of damning findings on the culture and attitudes towards dealing with rogue police. He said the integrity of and confidence in the Gardaí can only be maintained if suggestions of illegal conduct by members are taken seriously by management. This was welcomed by the Buchanan family solicitor, Ernie Waterworth.
Judge Smithick and his team deserve credit in what was a very trying and difficult process. They remain determined to complete their inquiry, despite all of the setbacks and obstacles which confronted them. To present the findings as they have is reassuring. Judge Smithick highlights his desire for the state to move away from this culture of ignoring wrongdoing and to embrace an open and honest approach in all matters, irrespective of the consequences. We now await with interest how the state responds to the findings and recommendations of Judge Smithick.
Well, the Gardaí say they are studying the report and they will not comment at this point. This evening, the Justice Minister, Alan Shatter, gave this reaction.
It is, of course, a matter of the utmost gravity that he's concluded that an unidentified member or unidentified members of An Garda Síochána in Dundalk Garda Station colluded with the IRA and that collusion resulted in the tragic death of two respected RUC officers. I want to, on behalf of the government and the state, unreservedly apologise to the families of both men for any failings on the part of this state.
Alan Shatter. Well, with me now in studio is RTE's Richard Dowling, who covered each day of the Smithick Tribunal. Also here, Sinn Féin TD Padraig McLaughlin. And on the phone is John Mooney, security correspondent with the Sunday Times. Richard, I'll start with you. What evidence does Judge Smithick produce to substantiate his collusion conclusion?
It's largely circumstantial. The judge in his own findings said he found no direct evidence of collusion. There was no phone tap. There was no money trail. However, what he said is that based on the evidence he's heard, which comes from a variety of sources, including intelligence information from the guards and from the RUC and PSNI, he says based on that evidence, and he has heard from some people who worked in British intelligence and worked as a British agent within the IRA. He's adamant that while there is no direct evidence, he says the circumstances are simply too far-fetched to think that this could be, as the IRA claimed, a long-term operation that they had underway. He says that they were aware that their main target was Chief Superintendent Harry Breen, particularly because he was identified with the incident in Loch Gull, where a number of IRA members were killed by the British security forces. Now, what the judge has basically said is, taking all this in the round, he said the circumstantial evidence is just too strong and that there was collusion. He doesn't identify the source of this collusion. There were three former Garda sergeants who were examined by the tribunal, and he's made no finding that they were the source of this information.
Were they all exonerated as possible collusionists?
Finbar Hickey was one former sergeant from Heckball's Cross. He actually was sentenced to a year in prison for providing false passport application forms, some of which ended up in the hands of the IRA. The judge said he wasn't in the station that day, he could not have been the source of the information. Now, Mr. Hickey claimed that he signed those forms because he was asked to by another sergeant who he knew, Leo Colton. Now, the judge said that there was evidence against Mr. Colton, but he made no finding that he was the source of this information. He said that by providing these passport forms, which ended up in the hands of the IRA, the judge said he's found, as a matter of fact, that Leo Colton had assisted the IRA in that matter. In relation to the other sergeant, Detective Sergeant Owen Corrigan, about whom much attention has been focused, he was named in the House of Parliament by Geoffrey Donaldson as being the mole. He's always strongly denied the allegation. Again, there was no finding that he had colluded with the IRA in these murders. Again, the judge said that there may have been, there was inappropriate dealings with the IRA, and that at some stage the then Detective Sergeant, Mr. Corrigan, may have passed information on to them. But there was nothing that he said, that there was no evidence that he was the source of this information, of this leak that led to the two RUC men being killed.
OK, John Mooney of the Sunday Times. If there's no actual hard evidence from the judge to prove collusion, he's basing his conclusions on intelligence, on the words of informers and agents. Does that weaken his conclusion?
I don't believe so, Audrey. I believe in many ways today's findings of the Smithwick Tribunal were inevitable. First of all, when people say there's no direct evidence, in many cases, indeed, in many crimes that are brought before a court, there is no, sometimes, direct evidence linking an accused person. But circumstantial evidence, is people seem to think that it's some sort of weakened or second-rate information. It's not. Any barrister will tell you if you a child emerges from a kitchen and has cream all over its mouth and you open the fridge and there's a cream cake with bites out of it, you can be pretty sure that the child is the person whom has eaten the cake, although you haven't seen it. You can adopt the exact same approach to this. The fact of the matter was there was a lot of technical surveillance, which I believe really pointed very much in the direction that there had been some form of collusion taking place. You had Gush had started, that's the CB and radio transmissions that were traditionally used by the IRA in South Armagh prior in advance of operations, had started shortly after those men arrived in Dundalk Station. That was a key giveaway in that. You also had a situation that this kind of attitude that, you know, you could have teams of men wandering around or hanging around for long periods of time, armed to the teeth in an area that was very heavily policed, simply wasn't true. And the IRA were very efficient in the South Armagh area and in North Louth as well. And that they didn't really unduly put themselves at too much risk if they didn't have to be, if they didn't have to. So they were very careful about their own integrity. Their own making sure that the operations that they engaged in, that they weren't caught. So it wasn't a case that, you know, you would have this sort of scenario whereby people just hung around with the potential that they could be arrested at any moment. That really didn't happen.
No, but so, there would have been cases where they would have carried out their own intelligence, whether it was through reconnaissance or, you know, following these people, working out their patterns.
Oh, absolutely. But you must remember with this, Audrey, that there had been a series of incidents in the preceding 2 or 3 years, which would have all suggested that the timing and sort of intelligence was very, very accurate. The other matter on this is that which is no one really likes to admit is that it, certainly the evidence that was furnished by the IRA to the tribunal was literally unbelievable. I'm aware of the individuals who met the tribunal. They would not subject themselves to any sort of cross-examination because they simply didn't want to get into a situation where they were answering questions or put themselves under that much scrutiny.
But do you accept, too, John, that, you know, that the evidence of the likes of people like Kevin Fulton, British agents, that, you know, it's all very murky and people will find a lot of this evidence unreliable?
Well, in some cases there are, and indeed I would argue that some of the evidence given by elements or the Gardaí, certainly who participated in it, were accused, certainly was unreliable, and Judge Smithwick states that. But Audrey, you've got to understand there was very, very accurate evidence given by the PSNI in the latter stages of the tribunal. Now, people would maybe not understand. I spend a lot of my working career along the border and dealing with the activities of Republican dissident groups, and there is a huge security operation still ongoing on both sides of the border, and because of the sort of the, I suppose, flourishing of organised crime, we've seen Garda officers murdered there in the past year or two, there is quite a substantial surveillance operation still in place around the border because that is still a requirement.
Okay.
It should be stated that, you know, the PSNI came in with intelligence that they believed, and they had it from credible sources, that whomever had been assisting the IRA to carry out this particular operation which resulted in these murders was actually not behind or had not appeared in front of the tribunal. And that's something that I know very much alarmed Garda headquarters, but I would be familiar with the intelligence gathering processes that were used to gather that information, and I have great faith in their accuracy.
All right, Richard, you wanted in there?
Yeah, there's some points there that John raised. The Gush, as he described it, which is the it's often just clicks and noises. There's no verbal communication. That actually started at around 11:30 on the morning of March 20th, which was the day of the ambush. Now, the RUC officers didn't leave their offices in Newry until around 2 o'clock or so. So that started well in advance. That was picked up by the watchtowers there. The judge has put a lot of weight behind that. There obviously was an operation put in place on the morning before the RUC officers had left. Now, the judge also heard that up to 70 IRA members would have been involved in it. That would have been taken the weapons out of deep hides into semi-hides and actually in the operation itself. And the other point, too, is what the former guards who were mentioned in the tribunal were all identified in various pieces of intelligence by either the guards, the RUC or the PSNI. Mm-hmm. Now, as I say, all three have strenuously denied that they were the source of this leak, but all have been identified in some shape or form. Now, the other issue that has been brought up was in relation to the intelligence that the PSNI brought forward to the tribunal. And what particularly angered the Gardaí was that information had not been shared with the Gardaí. The first the Gardaí heard about it was when it was presented in the tribunal. Now, the guards objected strongly to this delivery of the information. They said, if you want us to help catch the people involved in this, the information should be shared. And the last we heard is the information still had not been shared by the PSNI with the guards.
Okay. Padraig McLaughlin of Sinn Féin, do you accept the conclusions of Judge Smithick?
Well, I haven't had a chance to read the full report. It's his own report's 500 pages, and then it runs into, I think it's about 1,400 pages, the full appendix and so on. But I've had a chance to read some of the chapters, and I think I would leave it for people to make up their own mind. He reaches a conclusion. There's no direct evidence of collusion, but in the balance of probabilities, he's reached that conclusion.
Do you accept that?
I accept his finding. That's his finding. But I would leave it to people to have a look and read the evidence of the IRA, who, of their own volition, came forward in an unprecedented fashion and cooperated to try and get to, you know, the answers to the families in relation to what happened to their loved ones. In the wider context, if you look at what Judge Smithick describes as collusion in this instance, compared to what we had from the British state throughout the conflict, it's just, there's no comparison. What you had was an institutionalised, administratively run collusion by the British state from the formation of the UDA through the whole period of Frank Kitson, you know, the whole period of Dublin Monaghan, through to Brian Nelson, the recent book by Anne Cadwalder. So you had a massive form of collusion by the British
state. The end result is the same, though. People are dead.
Oh, absolutely. And people need answers. That's why in Sinn Féin, we would say there has to be an international truth commission, you know, overseen by a body like the UN, where all parties to the conflict come forward and try to provide answers to families about how their loved ones died. So I think that the Smithick Tribunal is an important contribution. It's part of the Weston Park Agreement in 2001.
We'll talk more about the wider reconciliation in a minute, but I mean, at the time back in 1989, you were just a teenager, but your party would have regarded these two men as legitimate targets.
Well, I think, you know, I'm conscious that the families today are thinking about their loved ones, but certainly in the context of that period, the IRA would have regarded them as legitimate targets at that time. They were both senior RUC officers. The RUC were despised within the nationalist community, responsible for huge you know, huge oppression, frankly. And that's why the RUC is gone, replaced by the PSNI today. But the fact is that two families lost their loved ones. They suffered grievous hurt and pain.
At the hands of the IRA.
Well, absolutely. And the IRA, you know, were responsible for inflicting hurt and pain on many, many families in the north of Ireland and elsewhere.
But there can't be any crocodile tears for these two men and their families now, when in 1989, the Republican movement, which included Sinn Féin, regarded them as legitimate targets.
Oh, the IRA came forward and openly, obviously, declared that they were responsible for that. And the fact is, at that time, you know, within that conflict, they wouldn't have been seen as innocent victims. They would have been seen as parties to the conflict who tragically, like thousands of others, lost their lives. But the truth is, the families do deserve answers, as do all the other families. And the problem right now is, you know, for example, the Western Park Agreement said that the Pat Finucane family would have answers. And so that's the only remaining issue now, that there hasn't even been an inquiry commenced. So the problem is that we now have two families that have some degree of answers and some degree of closure, and some others. But the overwhelming majority do not really know the circumstances. And I think that's the problem, is that we need to have a more comprehensive truth and answers commission where all sides acknowledge the hurt and pain they cause. But ultimately, you know, what we had was a profound political failure that led to this terrible conflict, and hopefully more and more answers will be given to families.
John Mooney, what's your view on the, I mean, that was 1989, we're 2013 now. What is your analysis of the wider significance of this Smithwick report?
Well, I suppose, like, I mean, I almost feel we're in a time loop sometimes. It's Groundhog Day with these type of tribunal reports, particularly the references to the guards. And if you look at Judge Smithwick, he's came out with various findings that I've heard on a number of occasions going back over the past 15 years, which is that internal guard investigations are very quick to rule out the involvement of rogue Gardaí or Gardaí who may be involved in crime. And indeed, Audrey, I've been on your show lots of times debating these issues in recent years. You know, I think on a general level, if you look at what the findings here, was this internal guard investigations into such allegations start out on the pretext that there's nothing to find and are very, very quick to reach such conclusions for what Judge Smithwick described as political expediency. And that continues right to this day still. I'm not saying with this type of case, it's very, very, you know, it's obviously a very complicated case. It happened in an extraordinarily turbulent time of modern Irish history, and there was wrongs committed on all sides. Indeed, we Panorama a couple of weeks ago pointing out how British Army soldiers were going around openly shooting people on from cars travelling along the sides of on roadways throughout West Belfast, and now we have a situation where it appears that someone within Dundalk Garda Station had assisted the Provisional IRA in South Armagh and North Louth to murder two senior RUC officers. These type of atrocities happened. I think what makes Ireland unique, or the handling of these allegations unique, is that we start out, and the guards have always traditionally started out with the view that there cannot be anything wrong with anyone who wears the uniform of an Garda Síochána. And that is, if you look at all the tribunals that have examined the actions of Gardaí in recent years, and indeed the reports by the Garda Ombudsman and different inquiries, they all come to the same conclusions. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it always is shown that the Minister of Justice for today comes out and will does his best to bash on behalf of Garda Headquarters. I think it's very noteworthy that Garda Headquarters have not made any public comment on this. The Garda Commissioner has not came out and apologised on behalf of the force for any failures have been shown up by Judge Smithwick's findings. I think Judge Smithwick's findings in many ways are very brave. I was speaking to senior Gardaí, many of whom gave evidence to tribunal in recent years, who had no inclination that he was going to come in with any adverse findings whatsoever, and for the simple reason is there was no direct evidence linking any single individual Gardaí to these atrocities.
Okay, John, thank you very much indeed. John Mooney there, security correspondent with the Sunday Times. Just before you go, Richard, is this the end of it now? I mean, as we've been saying, there's no hard evidence in this report. It's based mostly on intelligence and the words of informers and agents and so on. The mole hasn't been identified. This can't really go anywhere else, can it?
Well, it's not quite as historic as that. There are some recommendations that Judge Smithwick actually made, and they're still quite important. One of them is a protocol to exchange intelligence information. That is crucial, because both the guards and the PSNI, as we saw in the tribunal, there was a major spat between the two over the lack of transfer of intelligence. That's still a key issue, and that's an issue that still has to be resolved. Other recommendations include the secondment of members of either force into each other's force, if you don't know what I mean, to get an idea of how they work. And probably one of the other key issues is the idea of a cross-border police teams, so that both teams could cross into the other jurisdiction, either in a combined force or on their own, to pursue criminals to some level of degree. Now,
that happens already, though, to some extent.
It happened. I mean, it first happened into the murder investigation into the death of Paul Quinn. Mm. But what the judge is talking about is putting it onto a more formal basis, so that that idea can be expanded and worked on. So this isn't just an academic historical paper. There are issues here that need to be addressed by both senior Gardaí, senior PSNI officers and politicians on both sides of the border.
OK, Richard, thanks very much. Final word from you, Padraig, just on the Gardaí of today. Do you have faith that it's a very different Garda force of today than it was in 89?
I think that, you know, we have dealt in the Dáil in recent weeks with the issue of the concerns of the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission about the level of cooperation from the Gardaí with their investigations. One, a very serious investigation in relation to alleged collusion between members of the force and a major drug dealer in covering up activities. And unfortunately, the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission felt they didn't have the cooperation. And then the penalty points tobacco, which, you know, has exposed malpractice and poor practice. So, yes, the lessons are being learned. I think we need to get to the day where we have an independent policing authority, you know, moving the Garda Síochána into that type of, with a policing board, with appointments to senior Gardaí independent of the political system and fully accountable to the Ombudsman and to local joint policing committees. And that's where we need to get to. So, yeah, there are lessons. And we in Sinn Féin would agree with the recommendations almost in its entirety from Judge Smith.
OK, great. Thank you very much indeed to both of you for coming in tonight. Padraig McLaughlin of Sinn Féin and RTÉ's Richard Dowling. It's 26 minutes past 10. You're listening to The Late Debate. We're going to move on now and talk about the ongoing controversy involving the Central Remedial Clinic and their top-up payments from charitable donations to their top executives. The former chief executive, Paul Kiely, who still sits on the CRC's board, got an extra 100 grand plus. Other senior staff also got hefty top-ups. So far, the CRC has refused to answer why they believed it was acceptable to use charitable donations in this way, or to explain why senior staff were not asked to take a pay cut when junior staff had their pay slashed. The whole controversy has once again highlighted the large salaries enjoyed by a minority in the charity section and has provoked a debate on whether charities should be doing the work of the state. We'll be discussing all of this in a few minutes with independent TD Shane Ross, Fianna Fáil TD Sean Fleming, disability rights campaigner Martin Nocton and Deirdre Garvey, chief executive of The Wheel. That's the umbrella body for charities here. First, though, our regular contributor, the author and comedian Colm O'Regan, has been thinking about charities.
This column is going to be a bit moralising, so first, a confession. When I was 15, I was on a collection for Concern. Flag days were big events when you were a teenager. You got to go downtown, throw shapes in front of the girls, be noisy on the street. The Concern boxes that year were not very secure, as easy to get into as a tub of ice cream. After the collection, in the dark recesses of a snooker hall, I opened my box and took out a tenner. Even as a wannabe gouger, I knew it was properly wrong. The guilt was so much that I put the tenner back about an hour later. My moral compass was most activated by the breach of trust. The money was given to a fresh-faced, innocent me for one purpose and nearly used for another. It's different when we pay tax. It's compulsory, a fact of life like mouth ulcers. We do it and grumble. If, say, Faust somehow manages to lose a car or government ministers routinely breach their own advisor pay guidelines, we mutter darkly into our pints, saying, sure, what would you expect? They're all the same. But with charities, the act of giving is not just about the money. It's about feeling good about having given money. So when there are doubts, not only are we down a tenner, we also feel like eejits. There's been no stealing in this case, but the trust has gone, and trust needs to be replaced really quickly, which is why I still can't figure out how organisations at the centre of this haven't released statements saying, we did something wrong, we've stopped doing it wrong, and here's the money that we're no longer paying. Instead, all I've been hearing is words roughly to the effect of, well, the HSE were aware of it. This brings us to the age-old Irish excuse of a wrong thing is not wrong if A, someone else knew about it, B, sure they're all at it, and C, we can't do anything about it anyway because of legal considerations. Like commercial reasons, legal considerations is a euphemism for we've no balls. Namely, we can't take the money back or stop paying it because they might bring us to court. Well, why don't you take a chance on it? Bring them to court and bring all the cameras too. See what would happen. Of course, just because an organisation is a charity doesn't mean it isn't a business. I do gigs for charities for free, not necessarily because I support all the charities, but because someone else who's at the gig might give me other work. So it's not completely noble. The CEO of a charity should get a good wage, but I don't think you should go into charity for the money. By all means, do it for your CV and the exposure, but not for immediate financial gain. So come on, charitable organisations who are up to this, stop this top-up nonsense. The ones we've heard of and the ones we haven't. Sort it out quick. For your customers, for your employees, and for our direct debit arrangements. Put the tenors back in the box.
Telling it like it is, that was our regular contributor, author and comedian Colm O'Regan. Deirdre Garvey from The Wheel, that's the umbrella body for charity. Here. Is it acceptable that any boss of a charity gets paid more than 100 grand?
Well, in order to answer that, I think we need to understand what size charities we're talking about and whether charities employ significant numbers and whether they have multi-million euro budgets or whether they're responsible for 100,000 euro per year.
For example, the CRC then, let's take that as an example. Was it acceptable for Paul Kiely to receive such a huge salary, 272,000?
Personally, I don't think so. But what I will say is when a board of an independent charity is setting the salary level of a CEO for their organisation, I think there are many factors that have to be taken into account. I think it's what the market rate for the particular area of responsibility is. Can they get the right person to lead the charity to the successful impact for the beneficiaries that they have? But most of all, and very importantly of all, the process for deciding that salary level, whether it's 50,000 euro or 100,000 euro or more than that, has to be transparent, has to be justified and has to stack up.
A survey out at the end of October, it was carried out by the Irish Independent, showed that 14 charities, at least 14 charity bosses, got salaries of over 100 grand. And one of the top ones was Angela Cairns from Rehab. She gets 234,000. Is that justifiable?
Personally speaking, I don't think so. And I can tell you that the vast majority of charity CEOs in another survey of 400 charities, which was the only cross-sectoral survey ever done of charity CEOs' salaries, that shows that the average CEO of your average charity is paid 59,000 euro per year and that the vast majority of charity CEOs is paid 72,000 euro or less.
Other charities here, Enable Ireland, 145,000. That's Fionnuala O'Donovan. John McCormick of the Irish Cancer Society, 145,000. I mean, are those just what justifies a salary of over 100 grand in your view?
Well, I think it boils down to the level of responsibility. What size the, to use this word that was used by your commentator, what size of business it is. These organisations for charities that pay their CEOs more than 100,000 euro of some of those examples you're talking about, these are organisations that are multi-million euro organisations, companies. They have somewhere between 100 and 500 employees. They have a significant impact on the lives of either vulnerable people or communities in Ireland and internationally. I think that if you want to have a well-run organisation that creates maximum impact for the resources that go into that organisation, that in these cases where we see the rate for a principal officer in the public service, it has a salary range up to 110,000 euro, that these kinds of similar responsibilities are sometimes justifiable and in that level. But I can tell you that those kinds of charities that are 0.25% of all of the charities that employ staff in this country. And that's the kind of charity sector that we have. A very small number of large organisations and a vast number of organisations where these kinds of funds and those kinds of numbers are just pie in the sky. And it would be terrible if these organisations were to be cast in some sort of awful, untrusted light because of the actions of a very few.
Martin Nocton, do you accept anything there, what Deirdre said, in relation to salaries of over 100 grand? It depends.
I think when you're running an organisation that's more than just a charity, that it's some sort of an empire and things like that, and that it's hugely hugely funded by the state. I mean, we're talking about, if we talk about the Central Media Clinic, it also receives 16 plus million a year from the state and things like that. I really wonder if that's a charity at all. And I think that's one of the difficulties. And I think we're banding, we're giving charities a bad name generally because often as the way charity organisations are structured. And that's the biggest difficulty I have. And one of the other big problems I have is more and more I see it every day that organisations now are more dependent on the on its customers than the customers whom the organisations were set up for are on the organisation. And that's a reality. These machines have become money-eating machines in so many different ways. And the other part of it is they can be very disempowering both to parents and to individuals with disability. Now, I know that's a completely different question, but that's the root of the difficulty. I would also like to say that, right or wrong, this has already gone on too long, right? First of all, I'm very glad it's come out in the open. I've been listening to rumours forever and a day over the last few years. At least it's out there now. The sad thing about it is if charities were properly structured and if we had a regulator in place, which is the very least the public of Ireland deserve, considering how much they contribute in so many different ways. If there was a regulator in place, this we would have known what to do. We don't know whether we're waiting on the Public Accounts Committee. We don't know whether we're looking for an independent investigation. We don't know what we're looking for, really, at this stage. And that's hugely worrying.
And we don't know what else is to come out.
Yeah. I mean, already there, you've shocked me. And I'm saying, I wonder if there are any other parallel organisations even within them, where there could also, because that's what it seems to be that I'm listening to. Yeah, so I am really cross. As somebody with a disability who many, many years, spent many of my youth years out collecting and indeed for all the different charities. And I thought I was great. I used to get an egg and chips in the Pillar Cafe if I had a good day in collections. So, I mean, and good Lord, it's so sad and so depressing in a way. But please, people out there, listeners, don't stop giving. Be a little bit more select, be a little bit more careful and ask your public representatives to get a regulator in place as soon as possible to make sure that your money is protected and that it gets to where it's supposed to go.
Shane Ross, on the question of salaries, do you believe a figure over 100 grand is merited in any circumstance for the boss of a charity?
I think it'd be quite fair to put a maximum figure of 100,000 on a charity at this stage. You know, we've lost sight of what charities are doing. You need a very special type of person to work for a charity. And it's not someone who's completely and utterly money-minded and bottom-line minded. Charity does special things. It has to make decisions about humanity and preference and all sorts of very, very difficult decisions like doctors have to make from time to time. And I think that it's absolutely obscene that what's happened in this case, that in the case of CRC, that someone is getting a salary of 250,000 a year. It is utterly inexcusable. And what's happened here is that the charity, in these cases, they've run amok. They're not regulated. And so they are now able, or the board is now able to award them absurd amounts of money. And, you know, you asked the question about a figure. The interesting thing about Mr. Paul Kiely, who gets this huge sum from the CRC, is that now he's just retired and that they are now, in inverted commas, complying, is his successor, is getting around 100,000. So he was getting 2.5 times what actually is reckoned merited to have deserved. And you have to ask the question, how has this happened? Mm. And of course, Martin's right. It's partly non-regulation, but it's also all sorts of extraordinary factors have come to pass in the CRC, including, you know, the fact that the funding has been taken from the fundraisers, from actually the children or the potential for the children, and been put in the hands of top guys. That is absolutely unforgivable. And what I worry about is this. Yeah, I think what you mentioned there is possible. there will be other cases. There will no doubt be other cases. And there may be worse cases. I doubt it, because this is a really bad one. But there may be other cases. And if that happens, we are going to face a kind of appalling scenario, which has been outlined here by Martin again, where people will say, no, we're not going to give money. But people are entitled to demand where their money's going. That's the problem.
Sean Fleming, you're on the Public Accounts Committee as well, along with Shane Ross. When the CRC appear before you, do you know when they're going to make an appearance?
No, there's no date set yet. But in the first instance, this all stems from the report from the HSE of 43 organisations who are receiving the majority of their funding from the state to carry out their work. Mm-hmm. And the first question and the first point I think everybody would agree with, if you're in an organisation and the majority of your funding is coming from the taxpayer, you should be subject to public sector pay guideline, full stop, beginning mm-hmm. and end, and that should be the beginning.
What questions, though, will you have for the CRC representatives who come before you?
Well, first of all, before we get to there, in the first instance, we had the HSE in last week, who are the people managing this. And what's interesting is they issued the report 9 months ago. They've had this for 9 months. And at this point, only 7 of the 43 organisations are compliant with public sector pay guidelines. There's still 36, of which the CRC is one. There are 35 others. Mm. So the question I have to address to Tony O'Brien and the HSE is, we want the commitment before this year is out, which is only a couple of weeks away, that he will have met the chairperson of all the boards and absolutely confirmed, but independently verified from his perspective, that every one of those organisations will be compliant before this year is out. And really, I am starting with the HSE, because the taxpayer gives money to the HSE, who passes it on to the CRC and those other 43 organisations I mentioned. And the HSE are accountable in the first place for the money they hand out. Mm-hmm. So I'm putting some of the onus back on the HSE to make sure they're not handing out money, taxpayers' money, to all these organisations who are topping up their salaries. And I think in the first instance, that's my first line of questioning.
But it's as serious to be topping up salaries from charitable donations.
Oh, yeah, it is serious. But you ask what should happen. Should we bring
What questions? I want to know, what questions do you still have for the CRC when they appear before you?
Well, the first thing I will want to know from the chairman of the board, that's who I'm not too interested in, the chief executive, because he's the hired staff, the chairperson of the board, who is the person responsible. I will want an absolute assurance from the chairperson of the board that they're fully compliant and all top-ups have absolutely ceased into the future.
You don't want Des Pilo appearing before you?
Well, I don't think he's the current chairman.
No.
No, as the current chairman is responsible, and I will go one step further, any chairman of any of these organisations who can't provide that that assurance to the Irish taxpayer must step aside and allow somebody else chair the board who will give that assurance to the Irish taxpayer. And that applies to every one of the 36 organisations that are not yet in compliance.
Shane Ross, what questions will you have for them?
I have several. I think the first question, you know, we've heard Des Pilo, who's come out, who's 3 years out of the place, which makes it rather relevant. But the first question I would ask any of them is, and they're making the excuse that the HSE knew about it, who negotiated these salaries? Because it was obviously the board. The board are coming out and saying, look, we've got a contractual arrangement with these guys. We can't do anything about it, which is an absurd excuse, because they're the people who gave them this gold-plated contracts. And why did they give them these incredible amounts of money? So you ask them why they did it and how they did it and why they gave them so much above the guidelines. I mean, more than double in certain cases. That's the first question I'd ask them. Second question I'd ask them is, why were there no pay cuts for the top people in this place, when there was pay cuts all across the public service at this period of time? There was pay cuts for some of the lower staff, some of the really good, hardworking staff who were the victims, partially the victims with the children in this sort of thing. And the third question would be a very specific one, but it's enormous, because they keep saying, we didn't fund really very much more than the pay difference. In other words, the top ups. They admit to the top ups. I'd say, who in the name of God authorised them to give 3 million? To the pension funds in what is described as a loan, which what is quite obviously a gift from one to the other. It's interest free, it's unsecured, it's given all sorts of preferential treatment, and the accounts say, in direct contradiction to what the CRC says this morning, the accounts say that they really don't expect it ever to be paid back. And I'd ask them those questions just to start with. I mean, there are thousands of others. Were there other perks? What else was going on? How long back this went? Why they never would allow anybody to know the director's, the top guy, the chief executive's salary? People rang them up, journalists rang them up week after week after week and said, what's your salary? It was a secret, and it was kept a secret. The reason we now know is because he was paid excessively.
OK, Deirdre, you first and then Martin.
I think it's really important that it goes way beyond the transparency around the salary. I think every charitable organisation has to provide absolute and utter transparency about where the money is coming from, how much from which source, and where the money is going to, how much and onto what. And I think that is the basic minimum that the public requires. And it is an obligation of charities, which in effect receive a gift of a charitable status designation from the Irish public, from Irish society through the tax system. There is no such thing and can be no such thing as certain transparency rules for certain types of money and other transparency rules for other types of money. Once it passes in to the guardianship or custodianship of that charitable organisation, which is set up in the public benefit, absolute transparency.
Well, do you
must
demand
apply.
That of your members, the members who you represent?
We ask our members, we set standards, we demonstrate to them. But, and let's be clear, there are very many regulations that charities operate on right now. But the all-important final piece in the regulatory puzzle is missing. We have been campaigning for 10 years for the bringing in of the Charities Act 2009. And if there is a silver lining, if we could maybe step back or maybe step forward in 6 months' time, if there is a silver lining from this, this scandal, it is that we are going to hopefully have a mature debate about the role of charities in Irish society, about how we deliver public services in
this country, that there are...
and about the expediting of the bringing in of the necessary transparency through the bringing in of the charities regulator. We've been looking for it. It's badly needed. It needs to happen.
Your organisation, Deirdre, The Wheel, you represent, I know, hundreds of charities. They all come under your umbrella. But if we go back to the 14 charities whose bosses get salaries of over 100 grand, some of them are under your umbrella group. The Rehab Group is under your umbrella. I mean, have you made any attempt to investigate where that enormous salary for its boss comes from?
We are not a regulator, let's be very clear. We are a membership organisation, and what we do is expect our members to adhere to the highest standards of transparency. And that is why charities and community and voluntary organisations have banded together and produced various codes of practice for fundraising, for corporate governance. And we are urging all of our members to not wait to be asked for transparency. I believe it is the public's right. This is the public's trust is the greatest asset that our organisations and our sectors have.
Can you refuse to represent those who don't comply with your expectation of transparency?
If you want to become a member of The Wheel, you have to sign up to the values of The Wheel as set out for raising and professional standards and for sticking to certain standards.
But how many of those 14 charities, of which a number belong to your umbrella group, how many of them publish their accounts online?
I don't know the list of the 14 that you're talking about, but the national charities,
does
there
Rehab
would be household name charities, publish their accounts online. And when
does
we
Rehab,
have...
Does the Rehab Group publish their accounts
I don't
online?
Work for Rehab.
No, but
so
they come under your umbrella.
We have almost 1,000 organisations that are members of The Wheel. Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about these 14 whose bosses get a salary of over 100 grand. Rehab, the boss of Rehab being at the very highest, 234,000.
Regardless of whether they're members of The Wheel or not, what they definitely are, and they've been gifted charitable status by the revenue commissioners, and it's obvious that it's too much of a silver lining for some of those people. That's been what, and I would just like to say at the same time that while this has been going on, even just listening to Finney McGrath TD there over the last couple of days, that the services for people attending the central medial clinic has gone from 5 day to 3 day weeks, and in some cases from 3 to 1 day weeks. And these kind of these are not just a luxury in any kind of way. These are essential for people to who need these services. It's their only way to get out, to get therapy, to get this, so many different things, and so forth. From my own point of view, I really wish that, you know, that the board of the whole group actually, whether they're at fault or not, or how it's happened. You know, this is such a mess. Mm. And as a matter of honour, they should all step aside to make sure we never have anything like this again.
What is at the heart of it, Shane Ross? Is there too much political involvement?
Well, I think there's political involvement in some of them. CRC has this kind of coincidence, and I think I described it this morning on some programmes. It is quite extraordinary that four people who are so closely linked to Fianna Fáil have actually landed on this patch of land in Clontarf, which happens to be a central rebreathing clinic, and are running it. It's a kind of clique of similar people. And that raises the very serious question. And I rang Rehab this evening to ask them about this as well, because I don't know the answer. I mean, I should know the answer, but I don't know. I said, how do you elect your boards? Mm. And they came back and said, yeah, we'll come back to you. And they came back to me, and eventually they gave me a slightly confusing reply. But the basis of it was the board elects the board. In other words, they appoint each other and they appoint their powers if they want to and if they don't. That's, of course, absolutely against all corporate governance rules. And what the result of that means, that people have appoint their friends. Their friends then are in a position to make deals with the people at the top, who may be their friends as well. And then you get situations where guys get salaries which are massively in excess of what they get. So the first thing that should be done by the regulators is to make sure that boards are appointed in an absolutely upfront, transparent and independent way. And that's not happening at the moment. The result of that is the boards, and I haven't looked at enough of them, but the boards of a lot of these charities look to me as if they're a little bit too close to each other.
Sean Fleming, what do you say to that? In particular, I suppose, in relation to the CRC, in terms of all of the connections between some members of the board and your party.
Yeah, as I've already mentioned, there are 43 organisations involved, and there are some Fianna Fáil members, former members were on that board, some Fine Gael members were on that board. So I don't think the people want to hear the party politics on this issue. People want to deal with the charity issue. And really, when this story broke first, my first concern day one was that this could affect fundraising for charities that do very important work. And I do believe until we get absolute clarity, people will have an excuse not to give, because people, when they're giving, want to be comfortable about giving and want to know the money is going to where it should go. And we have questions and unanswered questions, and we're several weeks into this now.
Would you dispute that it's Fianna Fáil looking after their own in terms of the CRC board, in particular Jim Nugent, Paul Kiley, Brian Conlon?
Yeah, well, I think Des Pilo, I'm not here to mention names, but there are other names on that are clearly said they're members of other political parties. And what I am saying again here tonight, out of the 43 charities, you know, there might have been Fianna Fáil members on some of them. 40% of the country were voting for Fianna Fáil prior to the last election. So inevitably, out of the 43, I'm sure there are other Fianna Fáil.
But is it time politics got out of the boards of charities?
Well, funnily, there should be public transparency. My main concern about the appointment of these boards, they're a bit like private companies that are answerable to nobody, only their own private shareholders, which are themselves as director. Whereas there should be more public, like public boards, and people can go to their AGM and see who's been elected. There should be the board, the AGMs of these organisations. If the taxpayer, I go back to that point, if the taxpayer is providing the majority of the funding to these organisations, the AGM should be open to any taxpayer to attend those meetings and put their name forward for election as a taxpayer. And the only thing I would say is I wouldn't rule out everybody who's an interest in politics from being involved. I see all over the country there are people of different political shades involved in local community and voluntary organisations, and sometimes they're the same type of people that help everything. So I wouldn't just say that you have a blanket view, but I do want to see all these AGMs where the boards are being elected, auditors appointed, directors' fees being mentioned, if there are any directors' fees, and salaries for chief executive being approved at an open AGM that even the RTE cameras can attend. Mm.
Shane?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is more than a coincidence that there are, and Des Pilo is very closely linked to Fianna Fáil as well. I mean, it's quite a miracle he's a member of Fine Gael, because he's a great friend of Charlie Haughey. He had some wonderful things to say about Charlie Haughey on his 80th birthday, about how he was motivated by, you know, being a philanthropist, and that he achieved his objectives and he'd benefited Ireland, etc. He's a friend of Buddy Ahern. He's a friend of Charlie Haughey. He represented them at the tribunals as well. He's linked to Fianna Fáil, and the other three are. That's undeniable. And, you know, OK, it may be just a few pals get together over a pint in Fagan's pub and they appoint each other. It may be a bit more than that. That has got to end. And whether it's
Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, doesn't bother me. It's just got to end, because what happens then is Paul Kiely is chief executive and he's one of their friends and cronies as well. And of course, they get into a compromising situation. And this must be part of the reason why he got 250,000 per annum. So I don't think that's acceptable. We've got to clean it up. This thing has got to be tackled quickly. And what strikes me as very odd, and I'd be interested in the other guy's views about this, is this regulator is not going to be appointed until next year. Mm-hmm. Why in the name of God is the regulator not going to be appointed next year? Particularly now when this has emerged, there still is no sense of urgency in the government.
And the Act has been in place since 2009.
Yeah, since 2009. Yeah. And it's 2014, it's going to come into... And we're being told even today, sorry, and then we finish, that it's got to be introduced in stages. Why? Why can't it be done now?
Martin?
Well, just one quick little thing. I'd hate to see politicians not going near organisations and voluntary and charity organisations, because they are a great boost at different times and so forth. I have to say that about many organisations that I would be connected with. And I don't care what background they come from. They bring a bit of publicity. They bring a bit of energy very often, and they boost people together. So please, please don't stop. Mm. There's definitely a screw up here. It's a bad one. There's loads more Mr. Bumbles out there. There's a few more Mrs. Bumbles out there. We kind of know them, right? But, you know, it's somebody else better sort it out very quickly.
Do you draw on the regulator?
Yes, we've been campaigning for 10 years for a regulator. It was actually the Charities Act 2009 was enacted and signed by the President in February 2009. We and thousands of other charities welcomed that day, and unfortunately we're nearly coming up to the fifth anniversary of that. And it cannot happen soon enough. It should have happened before now. We are told that it will happen in 2014, next year. We are told, I think due to cost reasons, that it will happen in stages, is what we have been told by the Department of Justice. And really, I think that it has not been good enough for the charity sector, because really, this is a regulator that is there to enhance and maintain the public's trust. These are public benefit organisations. They are de facto owned by Irish society. And it is Irish society and the beneficiaries and the participants and the volunteers who engage with these organisations who are the losers if public trust is diminished. And we can't afford that.
Sean?
I think the regulator should be appointed straight away, and I don't believe there's an additional cost, because we've now seen in the last 6 months the HSE are actually doing their own regulation, internal audit reports. They've had to assign a team of their own senior officials to follow through these 43 organisations. That's the work a regulator should be starting with. It's actually being done now. And I would prefer to see senior people in the HSE managing the health service than being caught in this financial issue, and the staff, and there would be no extra cost to the taxpayer if the regulator had staff in his office rather than the HSE having to use their valuable staff following up this issue.
Martin.
Yeah. Well, just a little bit of good news, because I know we're coming to the end of the programme, and to many people with disabilities out there who depend very much on the mobility allowance, just to let you know, just to let them know that it's going to continue for the time being. It's not going to stop this side of Christmas or anything like that, and that the new scheme is going to be put in place probably in the first half of next year, which will open it up to more people. But anybody who's got the scheme are going to keep it going forward, at least until the new scheme is in place. And I think it's very important to give that good news.
Absolutely, that's great news. And that's a story that we follow very closely here on this programme. But new applicants still will have to wait.
We'll have to wait until the new scheme is in place, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But we're still putting pressure on. But at least that bit of good news went to government this week and came out approval. So,
well, that's okay. Great. Thank you very much for that. Shane, I'll just read you a headline in tomorrow morning's Irish Times. The CRC chief's appointment highly irregular, says the HSE. It's a story by Martin Wall. The HSE served an unprecedented 2 formal warnings on the Central Remedial Clinic earlier this year regarding the appointment process for its new chief executive, which it described as highly irregular. Confidential internal files seen by the Irish Times also show that at one point during the summer, the HSE said it was considering suspending nearly a quarter of a million euro in funding as part of the row. The documents show that the CRC moved to appoint a replacement for Paul Kiely without official approval and in contravention of direct instructions issued by the HSE.
Yeah, I've heard these kind of rumours around. That's interesting. It's actually emerged in print.
I think that's one of the other questions which will have to be asked the PAC. There are a lot of questions about how that was conducted, how that interview was conducted, who conducted that interview, whether it was openly advertised or just internally advertised, whether people were sprung at the last minute, and indeed how they actually chose the candidate. There's a strange pattern of people emerging in the CRC to that job. A lot of them seem to have come from, the last two seem to come from the Marta stable, which is something we should be asked about as well.
Yeah. Do you expect the CRC to be before your committee, before the end of the Dáil term?
Yes.
Yes,
you do. I would very much hope so, good. Yeah.
All right. Shane Ross, Sean Fleming, Deirdre Garvey and Martin Nocton, thank you all very much indeed for coming in to us tonight. We're back with more at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Until then, from all the team, good night.
The Late Debate with Audrey Carvel was produced by Donal O'Herlihy, and the broadcast coordinator tonight was Maeve Mooney. The researcher is Richie Byrne, and sound supervision tonight was by Pather Carney.